Welcome to Recess Now, a resuscitation podcast for all things EMS, emergency medicine, and critical care. I'm Ralph Seymour, physician assistant in emergency medicine and critical care. Today, I'm joined by an interventional cardiologist, Dean Ferreira, to join us on the podcast for the subject of post-cardiac arrest catheterization referral. Now, it's been a topic that's been an interesting one, and there's been recent articles and data to support or not support the sending these patients to the cardiac catheterization lab. And Dean was good enough to join us on the podcast for episode 3. So Dean, just tell everybody who you are and what you do.
Well, thanks for having me here. It's a pleasure. I am an interventional cardiologist practicing in the Chicagoland, Northwest Indiana corridor. And, you know, obviously in my line of work, we are the go-to people for STEMI, non-STEMI management. And, of course, we're involved in treating a lot of patients directly, but also through the ER team in sideline management and helping to, you know, coordinate how we manage the not only the throughput, but whatever the best practice approach would be for patients with either acute ACS syndrome by STEMI or non-STEMI, and in and amongst out-of-hospital cardiac arrest.
Yeah, well, we really appreciate having you on. And the main reason I thought of you is we've always had a sort of anxiety about when we have a patient that comes into with cardiac arrest and we get something back. We'll just say we're going to use an arbitrary number of a 65-year-old patient that comes in cardiac arrest, and it's a V-fib arrest. And we get something back in a reasonable amount of time. Defining reasonable is about a 10-minute downtime with CPR and defibrillation. Now, we get the first thing that I do, besides assuring that we have stability with vital signs, is I get an EKG. Now, when we get the EKG, The STEMI isn't always going to be present on the EKG after these arrests. The most common cause of death we know is myocardial infarction, and it would make sense to assume that these patients are having a STEMI until proven otherwise. But maybe the data doesn't bear that out the way we think it should. So I guess, you know, my question for you to start things off is, which patients need to go to the cath lab?
Yeah, so it's a loaded question. It sounds pretty simple, but it's loaded. You know, we can always follow and reference back to, you know, the ACS, STEMI, and non-STEMI guidelines, respectively, to help make that decision. But really, you know, in my mind, first thing I think about is, you know, what's the history of this patient? You know, how did they present? Where did they come from? Who found them? You know, were they at home? Did they pass out at home? Did they grab their chest before they went down? Did a loved one start pushing on their chest as they called 911? Or were they just found somewhere by the street and, you know, without much bystander attention? And then we recognize that in transport to your facility or any facility that they're showing signs of a critical arrhythmia. And then that arrhythmia is treated. And then perhaps it's a quick turnover, or perhaps it's not. And that little bit of history, I think, is a really good guide, because if you can at least identify those who have had a short window of downtime, who have had prompt treatment, and who have had good, you know, first contact with medical care on a minimal temporal basis, then I think you're identifying, you know, truly the most viable patient. And when you identify that, you have the best chance of resuscitating them, but then hopefully you'll have a better chance of also figuring out what the driver was.
Sure.
And I mention that because, you know, if we're talking in the non-STEMI field, you know, not everything that comes into you with signs of a high troponin or an arrhythmia is driven principally by, you know, the myocardial infarct is the thing that made them go down. And those are the patients that we have to separate out.
Right. No, excellent. Yeah, I think this, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that this applies to the paramedics in the field as well. Now, the story is an important part of the equation when we're taking care of post-arrest patients. Not just, you know, everybody has so much anxiety when they're, you know, doing all the things that we have to do. You're intubating, you're doing CPR, you're thinking of the ACLS protocol and the things of that nature. But the other key component, as you just pointed out, is the story that is attached to this patient. Now, did they clutch their chest? Did they say they were having chest pain for 3 hours before this event took place and they didn't want to go to the hospital? All of these things being brought to the bedside, to the emergency physician's attention, will help guide the care going forward. And the other thing that's worth noting is that bringing a post-arrest with ROSC to a non-interventional center may not be the best thing if the story is good for ACS.
Sure, yeah.
Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. I mean, I think that our duty is to try to get them to the appropriate center. And look, when you're in the field making that decision, you know, as the interventional cardiologist, I want to weigh towards thinking it's an acute ACS so that I can, you know, affect treatment, you know, as quickly as possible. But
yeah.
As I mentioned, some of them are going to have other conditions that are really driving the show, and perhaps they're not going to be the, you know, the first person you take to the cath lab. But from the decision making of what's the best center, I mean, ideally, yes, an ACS center, a chest pain approved center, or a center that has cath lab facilities would be, you know, the most logical choice if you can get there.
Yeah. So I think the thing that makes me have anxiety when I get a patient with cardiac arrest back in the emergency department, and it doesn't matter. Let's just say it was VFib and we've shocked them, we've given them antiarrhythmic, and now they're back. Okay, so now what? We get the EKG. The EKG has isoelectric ST segments. There's no STEMI on the EKG. Now, the question comes, what was the history? Let's just say the history is unknown. We don't have a known history with this patient. We don't know what the downtime really was, but we do know that the patient, well, we'll just use this, the 65-year-old patient again that comes in, and we know that it was a VFib arrest, and we know that there was 10 minutes of CPR. What would it take for me to convince you as the interventionalist in the presence of a non-STEMI to come in and take this patient to the cath lab?
No, great question. I think a lot of this still centers around the history, and there's going to be some unknowns, but I'll give you my inkling so it makes a little bit more clear sense. If we know that this is a patient that had recent angina, has a history of CAD, or has high CAD risk factors, male, 65, diabetic, hypertensive, smoker, we know the risk factors. If they're falling into that category and they come in down and we have quick ROSC and that patient, you know, has signs of cerebral function, these are the ones that we're going to keep a close eye on. But if they have isoelectric ST segment changes, you know, you have time. And the reason why you have time is because statistically there's not much more of a benefit. And rapidly bringing that patient to the cath lab. If you have somebody with ST segment elevation, that's a little bit different ball of wax. But if we're talking just the isoelectric ST segment changes and a poor history of, you know, of ACS sounding clinical scenario, meaning, you know, let's say it was a 70-year-old, you know, gentleman who's, you know, pretty debilitated, found down, has some bed sores, or has a, you know, a history of chronic UTIs and potentially is septic. I mean, of course they could have CAD, mm-hmm. and of course they could get to a point of illness where they drive myocardial, you know, dysfunction, myocardial work demand, and such that they develop something of a demand mismatch ischemia, but they're more of a septic picture. And so those are patients that you definitely don't want to take to the lab.
Sure.
You want to make sure that you treat, you know, first the underlying thing. But yes, if we're talking about non-ST elevation myocardial infarction status post-cardiac arrest, the data would suggest that there's not an urgent need to rush them to the lab.
Sure. And you know, the article that we're specifically going to post in the show notes about this is a New England Journal article that really kind of looked at this pretty closely. And really, they found no benefit to the patients going to the cath lab with in the setting of a non-STEMI post-arrest. For the most part, they really didn't find any benefit to that, and we're going to post that article because I think it's a widely talked about article in this setting. Because really, that's all I think about when I get a patient back is what now? What now?
Yeah.
You know, is there something that we can do to reverse the underlying cause? Yes or no? And if there isn't, and it's just more of a watch and wait and support the patient in the ICU, then fine. I have no issue with that. But if there is something that we can do to reverse the underlying cause of the arrest, then I'm all for it.
Yeah.
And I think that everybody else should be all for it as well. Now, when we have a STEMI on the EKG after the patient is resuscitated from a cardiac arrest of whatever downtime, is there any hesitation or any doubt that that patient needs to go directly to the lab?
Yeah, I still think even in the case of STEMI, there is. But let's back up for a second and talk about that article, because I believe it was called the COETS article, COETS or COECTS, something like that. But one key thing I want to mention in that article is that I believe the key therapy was cooling. So those patients were out of hospital cardiac arrest, and they had an early intervention arm, meaning early angiography arm, versus a delayed angiography arm. And they both fared rather equally. This is non-ST elevation myocardial infarction or non-STE SCS in the setting of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. But both groups received cooling. And I think they had 5 hours to target temperature cooling time. So to me, that is your treatment. And I know that in the ED, your team is excellent at, the rapid medical decision making and really making sure that, all the key life-saving elements and decision points are made rapidly so that you can really generate good viability of any patient you touch. And so this falls into that format. You don't want to miss an ACS that would benefit from early intervention. But I think in non-ST ACS, there's some data that suggests that you're not doing any disharm or any, you're not doing anything negative to the patient's care unless you omit cooling. And I think, cooling is cornerstone of that care.
Yeah.
Now to get back to STEMI, now STEMI is still tricky. A lot of interventionalists, we all know it. A lot of us like to talk about the fact that this is all highly monitored. And, the reality is that you want to take the most viable patients to the cath lab for the sake of your program. And that sounds a little curt, but the reality is if you don't manage your program well and have good quality metrics and low death rate, then your program gets threatened. But not only that, you also don't want to promote harm of individuals that don't really benefit. I mean, if it's my loved one and they've had prolonged downtime and their EKG is showing STEMI and they're, having pure signs of cognitive and cerebral dysfunction with posturing, etc., I mean, the chance of meaningful survival to the point where that person's going to be the person they want to be is relatively low, and why hasten that with any other works of potential harm? The guidelines will support out-of-hospital cardiac arrest in STEMI patients, but check it out. I think there's a better way to, not a better way, but a good way to at least, monitor some of these patients or at least do the diagnostic workup prior to deciding who goes to the lab. That does bear some weight on lab work. Those who are very acidotic, those who have a high lactate level greater than 9, pH less than 7.2, we know that their long-term recovery from this is marginal. And then you're potentially, bringing a patient to the cath lab that's just not going to do well. But here's where the history comes in. Perhaps you're more willing to do it if you know that this person just you know, collapsed at home, you know, wife or husband pushed on the chest. EMS was called very quickly. ACS was diagnosed very quickly. There was a shock perhaps, but it was minimal. Patient may or may not be waking up, but you've had a short window of downtime with bystander CPR, witnessed arrest. You know, these are the patients that you're willing to say, all right, the labs might not look great, but I'm still going to give it a go, because hopefully, you know, they're younger, they're more viable, but without much, you know, without much downtime to really cause a lot of cerebral anoxia. And all of us, I think, in this field have been impressed, right? I mean, you've had some patients that you didn't think were going to make it, and they do. And
sure.
So I think we always err on the side of going. But some of these patients are just going to be, you know, very sick, and perhaps you're not going to provide them with such benefit. So I think, benefit is less. The risk of harm is greater. We've got to be judgmental on those patients.
So yeah, I'm taking a lot from what you just said, and I think taking their current neurologic status into play probably plays a huge role in your decision to come in.
Sure.
You know, I mean, you taking the age and the comorbidities and all the things that go along with that, whether or not it's important, to come in, or maybe we should just think about what the end quality of life is most likely to be at the end of that, whether it's worth going to the cath lab or not. And I don't want to, maybe I sound curt, but I mean, we want to first do no harm. We want to support the realistic chance of anybody having a meaningful recovery. But so I guess the neurologic status at the time that they've been resuscitated, is that information that you're going to want to know?
Yeah, I mean, you put it succinctly. You know, the neurologic status is king here. I mean, it doesn't matter what I do for a patient if they've had such bad cerebral anoxia and such bad hypoxic encephalopathy that they're not going to recover.
I mean, yeah.
It makes no sense to work on somebody's heart for the sake of keeping their them out of pump failure and keeping them out of dysrhythmias if they're never going to wake up. I mean, the brain is king here, right? I mean,
sure.
We act like heart is king, but brain is king. Right?
Yeah.
So that's where we have to be focused on targeted temperature management. Again, you can cool people in cath lab. You can if you feel that a specific case merits it. I mean, we have guidelines of practice, but I must stress that they're guidelines of practice.
Yes.
I mean, they're not, they're not a recipe or cookbook for how every patient needs to be treated.
Yeah.
They're a guideline of practice. And so you'll have those cases where you're worried about them and they've had a marginal neurologic status. But there's other good prognostic matters. Markers. They're not very acidotic. They had a quick shock dysrhythmia back into normal sinus.
Sure.
They've stabilized their hemodynamics. And, in those patients, maybe it's worth, starting the cooling protocol and rapidly cathing them.
So that's an interesting segue, because one of the things that I worry about as a clinician, and I'm sure that most emergency medicine clinicians worry about the same, is the coagulopathy.
Sure.
So when we cool patients to a target temperature of 33 degrees Celsius, we know already that we are compromising the coagulation cascade. We know that already. And you guys are going to be giving heparin and other things to poison the coagulation cascade as well. And I say poison, but you know what I mean. Now,
manage.
Will you bring a patient to the cath lab that has already reached target temperature of 33 degrees, or do you have pause?
Well, no, you can. You can manage cooled patients in the cath lab. You can cath those patients. Depending upon the management style of hypothermia, I mean, it can become difficult if they have Arctic sun pads on or an indwelling catheter. I mean, you have to worry about all that. I think we do have to be particularly concerned about coagulopathy and bleeding risk. I mean, any like any patient bringing to cath lab, you're always worried about bleeding risk. But it does add another element of interesting management needs.
Yeah.
You also must be aware of the other side of it, which is sometimes patients have just been, and I've been on this side of it where, you have a conversation with an ER about somebody who's had some downtime. They're maybe en route from EMS if you're getting a call from the field, or they just hit the ER. And so, okay, there's a STEMI, lab gets activated, we all come in, and by the time you get the patient on the table, they're showing signs of pure bleeding from their mucous membranes and whatnot. And,
yeah.
And they've developed DIC. And so, and you're like, geez, okay, this is not somebody that...
So what do you do as a cardiologist?
Those are the kind of cases, I've had it happen to me a couple of times. By the time you're getting there, they're showing signs of DIC. And I think what that means is we probably, didn't have the correct story as far as how long they were down. And,
sure.
And that's no one's fault, right? I mean, it just, maybe it's what the family told us, or maybe it's just unknown. But, those patients, I mean, you back away. I mean, your risk of harm is great. It's also just a bad prognostic marker for viability.
Yeah, and also a huge risk for you, because you're going to be accessing the femoral artery. I don't know how often you're thinking about the sequela of a post-catheterization pseudoaneurysm. But you're going to get called.
All the time. Yeah. You think about it. I mean, it is, it's a big push. I do a lot of radial catheterization, and one of the benefits of doing radial caths, particularly in STEMI, is there's a lesser bleeding risk, particularly in women. But we always have to think about it.
Yeah.
Because bleeding endpoints, in interventional cardiology literature, I mean, bleeding endpoints become ischemic endpoints. If somebody bleeds, they drop their hemoglobin down, if they become hypotensive from it, I mean, it drives up more ischemia on some level, coronary or cerebral, because you have to resuscitate a patient who's got lower oxygen carrying capacity. So it's bad.
Yeah, yeah, sure. I guess another question that I have for you is a patient that precipitously arrests in the emergency department with a known STEMI. We're waiting and providing the usual care that we would normally give, whether that's a bolus load of heparin and aspirin. That's usually where I stop with STEMI and then get them packaged to go to the cath lab. And then they arrest. Let's just say that this patient arrests and goes into cardiac arrest and gets CPR. What is the utility? And this isn't a gotcha question. This is just a question. When you're doing CPR, either by the Lucas device or by mechanical CPR by a person, can you cath these people while they're getting CPR?
It gets tricky. I mean, with the devices, so to back up, the short answer is yes. I mean, some of them are made to be visualized through the C-arm, and are more radiolucent. I've never personally worked with one of them or cath somebody on it, but that technology is delivered to be amenable to cath in some levels. So it's hard to be doing an emergency case while a person is pushing on the chest, in part because I'm just delivering loads of X-ray to whatever tech or nurse is helping. So that's not good. When it comes down to it, that is one of the things the American College of Cardiology follows, which is salvage acute angioplasty procedures, salvage emergent angioplasty procedures would imply somebody who's literally had an arrest within 10 minutes of being in a lab, and because it's felt that they are not going to live without you revascularizing something.
Sure.
That doesn't always have to be an unconscious patient.
Yeah.
But more often than not, it is. And those are tough. And when you call me and you say, hey, this guy came in, he looked a little diaphoretic, had marginally shocky blood pressures, I gave him a fluid bolus, we got the EKG, we got him lined and labbed, and lo and behold, he's only in my purview for 8 minutes, and then he just went down. you know, those are the patients that, yeah, I'm chomping at the bit to get in the lab, because I know that the best possible outcome is, you know, potentially available because they rested in front of you. They had all the care they could have gotten, you know. Yeah. They, you know, if they had rested at home, they wouldn't make it, most likely. But sure. If they rested in front of you, I mean, you've got a crew of people, you're calling a code, you're intubating, you're managing, you know, hemodynamics the best you can, you're doing mechanical circulatory support by either, you know, hand or Lucas device, whatever, but you're doing what you can do.
Yeah. I you know, another thing I wanted to ask you on the show is how you know, this is one of the things that we talk about in the emergency department is, you know, when I have a cardiologist's confidence to come in and take care of a patient emergently and not, you know, a delayed cath, you know, 12 hours from now or whatever, that means they believed what I told them on the phone, and they have confidence in that and they come in. How often do you bring somebody to a lab post-arrest that has clean coronaries but had a great story?
Well, it's certainly
a great EKG.
I mean, it certainly happened, but you know, some of it comes in the history again. You know, you can get fooled on those that, you know, just look bad because they're septic and have, you know, hyperkalemia. I mean, things can happen that you miss, and that's, you know, part of the consideration when somebody comes in and you're rapidly trying to triage and get them into the lab. If the story isn't good, but then they've been down and then you see an EKG that looks funky with ST segment changes, and let's say they've been septic and dry and they're in renal failure and they're hyperkalemic, I mean, you know, you don't know that. You're just rushing to get them into the cath lab. And I think that's some of the times where we have to.
So, you know, we're talking about the post-arrest. We're talking about, you know, we've mentioned that when a patient arrests in the emergency department, how difficult it is to perform a cardiac catheterization with mechanical CPR and all of those types of things. I guess, you know, to summarize everything that we've talked about. When a patient comes in cardiac arrest, because I want the people that listen to this to get something out of it in the way that helps their practice every single day. That's the goal. So which patients do we call you for? Do we call you for all of them? I think we went through, number one, the patient has to have a good story. Number two, and we're saying that the EKG is isoelectric with respect to the ST segment.
Yeah, but there's one type of EKG I want to mention too, which is...
Okay, go.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, kind of a common call we'll get is, hey, I got this guy, he came in, maybe he arrested, maybe he didn't, maybe a chest pain, maybe he didn't, but, you know, the EKG looks diffusely ischemic. Mm-hmm. And obviously, when we think about a diffusely ischemic EKG outside of ST elevation, we think, you know, diffuse ST depressions. It's pretty common call for me to hear, hey, there's some ST elevation AVR, the rest shows ST depression. This is, you know, an EKG that I think, you know, I mean, it raises the hair on the back of my neck just like it does yours. It's certainly a sign of diffuse ischemia. But again, what's the story? I mean, you know, if the patient is presenting with severe chest pain that came on out of the blue or had this kind of an EKG and arrested suddenly, but had a good bystander, you know, appearance to help out, CPR, all that, you know, good stuff. You know, that's certainly somebody that you're going to want to, you know, you figure out rapidly. And that might even include, you know, thinking outside the guideline of, hey, or not guideline, but thinking outside the box of, hey, if it's a non-ST elevation myocardial infarction, I don't need to rush him to the lab. But maybe that one is. But if that same patient comes in with an AVR elevation, diffuse ST segment depression, and is really hypertensive or had, you know, classic pulmonary edema on chest x-ray, you know, I could always rationalize that, of course, they're gonna have an ischemic load to that heart. I mean, they have ischemic heart disease. Yes, I'll agree with that. I think they have diffuse CAD, and it could be severe. But those patients do require treatment prior, you know, above and beyond going to the cath lab, they, in my opinion, require a lot of treatment in the ED to help get them out of whatever ischemic spiral has been triggered. And that could be, you know, classically flash pulmonary edema, somebody with a low ejection fraction that became hypertensive, went into heart pump failure, came in and is hypoxic, or they're, you know, have a rip-roaring pneumonia and they're hypoxic, and then their EKG is showing this kind of situation. Happened to me once where I think somebody had carbon monoxide poisoning from the ER, and you know the treatment there is you know, get them to a hyperbaric chamber.
Sure.
You know, I mean, they had a good story for carbon monoxide poisoning. That's not somebody I want to bring to the cath lab.
Absolutely. I'm glad you said that.
So whatever's causing that, you know, level of demand mismatch ischemia, which is significant, needs to be rectified. And then, yes, at some point, they should have a cath. But the timing on that is not always emergent.
Sure. So I for those of you out there that don't understand what we were just talking about, I think it's important to clarify. The EKG in of subject in this situation would be diffuse ST depression with elevation, ST elevation in AVR. Now, what that means usually is that you have a clot in the left main coronary artery or the proximal LAD, or it could be triple vessel disease.
Yeah, I don't always think of it as a clot. I just think of it as severe disease.
Severe disease.
Yeah, so they have severe diffuse multivessel or left main disease.
Okay.
And I don't always think of it as a closed vessel pattern with a clot. It could be. But it could also be just, you know, bad rip-roaring demand mismatch ischemia.
Now, these patients, you are an advocate of bringing emergent or semi-urgently to the lab.
I'm in favor of bringing them more semi-urgently if I can. And with that, I mean, you know, I have an opportunity to help stabilize them. The other nightmare that happens in the cath lab is, let's say you bring all those patients to the cath lab and they've shown up and they're hypoxic because they're in, you know, rip-roaring pulmonary edema, and at the time you don't know it, but they're probably in severe pump failure. Meaning, let's say for argument's sake that, you know, if you had the ability to throw a bedside echo on them and you see that the EF is like, hey doc, it's 20-25% LVEF I'm looking at here, I just did a quick ER bedside echo, chest x-ray shows a lot of pulmonary edema, they're pretty hypertensive, you know, and in that situation, I'm going to say, okay, you know, they're hypoxic, they're hypertensive, they're in clear pump failure, and they're in clear pulmonary edema, and they have a bad-looking EKG. Because they're in a state of demand mismatch ischemia driven by pulmonary edema and hypoxemia. So I'm going to say to you, you know, let's try to unload that ventricle with nitrates. Let's start some diuretics. The counter argument is, if I rush them all to the cath lab, you know, what happens when you see these patients coming in from an ambulance or in your ER? They're sitting in the cart, right?
Yeah.
And they're pretty upright. You know? They're more upright because they need to recruit more airspace because they're in such bad pulmonary edema that they need to use that extra work of gravity. And they're not showing you their orthopnea or their orthodeoxia yet.
Yeah.
But where are they in the cath lab? They're flat on their back.
Yeah.
They're flat. And they're in a state of orthodeoxia that can happen. And then also, we will put them on supplemental O2. O2 requirements go up. And now, let's say they do have some critical lesions that I'm working on. I'm only going to make them, you know, have a little bit more myocardial stunning.
Yeah.
So those kinds of patients, if they're hemodynamically stable and there's clearly signs of something else driving, you know, that demand mismatch ischemia, and the EKG is reflecting it.
Yeah,
my preference is to stabilize the other stuff, and that might even include you intubating them.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
Ralph. Because if you intubate them, then you stabilize their airway. We start to diurese them, right? We get their hemodynamics under control, and then if we cath them emergently, we have at least the ability to maintain, you know, good oxygenation.
Sure.
Which is really important. If they're just showing that EKG, they're having chest pain, they're hypotensive. You know, those are the ones I'm going to be like, all right, blood pressure's low, EKG looks bad, they're not quite in pump failure yet. You know, something is more active. That could be something clotting, right? So that's the one I'm going to say, let's get him into the lab.
Got it.
And you might see this EKG pattern after a cardiac arrest.
Yeah.
And those are the tricky ones. You know?
Yeah, because you don't know. You just don't know.
You don't know, but you might need time to get more data. And I'm a believer, if you're going to treat people the right way, it also means not making, you know, a binary decision based upon, you know, what somebody is taught or told us or... You know, everybody gets through their medical training thinking like, you know, STEMI cath lab, right?
I mean,
but it's not all a binary decision when you're treating real people and you've got to decide, you know, what is the best method of getting this patient under control? And is that emergency cath because they're hypotensive?
Okay.
Or is that let's take care of whatever's driving it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You might need a minute to get a chest x-ray to get some stat labs on that patient before you do it. Yeah. And those are the ones that you asked, you know, what do you tell me or as a cardiologist or how do we take care of that patient together is what you're alluding to. And those are the ones where I say, okay, hey, here's what I'm thinking. You know, can you agree? Let's get a couple set of labs. Let's figure out which way they're teetering. And then let's make the final decision again together. It's joint decision making. As a cardiologist, I don't feel that, you know, the ER... team needs to really convince me of anything. They just, you know, have to be the best eyes and ears available to me and give me their clinical input, because your clinical input is invaluable to me. If you think that, like, hey, this, you know, everything I've got on the table with this guy is that he just went down because he had chest pain and he's got all the risk factors and I'm talking to family and it's bad. Okay, I get it. Yeah. You didn't have much downtime. Let's go.
Yeah, I like that. You know, I have always had pause when it came to the EKG that you described. The reason I've had pause is anecdotal. The patient that has the diffuse ST depression with elevation in AVR may have triple vessel disease, may have an acute event going on in the left coronary artery or the proximal LAD. Now, what are you going to do about it? I mean, if it's the left coronary artery, are you going to stent that? Can you stent that? I mean, is that something you can do anything about?
You can stent the left main. I don't think anybody really loves stenting a left main emergently. I've done it. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's always a, you know, a kind of a bailout type of thing to do emergently.
Yeah.
It depends. So first things first is hemodynamics are king and you know, are your arrhythmias being managed appropriately? In the cath lab, if they're looking shocky, you can, you know, nowadays we have options for mechanical circulatory support. And by that I mean, you know, percutaneous left ventricular assist devices. A common one most labs carry is the Impella device. There are some others, CardioHelp, Tandem Heart, these work a little bit differently. But, you know, if you have that available to you, you can employ that. You can use balloon pump. You can do emergent coronary revascularization.
Now, your balloon pump would be something that you would consider. I'm using balloon pump because that's what we do at our shop. But Impella or LVAD would be something that could be readily available to you in the event that you needed it in that kind of a situation?
Yeah, I wouldn't say readily available. You know, it's going to depend on your site and your center, whether or not you have an Impella program or a PVAD, percutaneous VAD program. I think balloon pumps are pretty universal, and you know, balloon pumps are helpful. We're getting into the territory of shock data set, and plenty of people can argue and talk about the shock data set that balloon pumps, you know, may or may not help or don't help. But I think the bottom line is there. You're in the realm of if they're a hypotensive patient with multivessel coronary disease that's had an arrest that you're trying to manage, you may or may not, based upon what's going on with the patient, decide just vasopressors, an intra-aortic balloon pump, which is a type of mechanical circulatory support, or maybe even taking it up another notch. And those those are, you know, not, so to speak, universal, but are more site-specific in different centers. So that those might be the options. Sometimes, yeah, you know, if you're working at a place where you have CT surgical team available and you feel you can stabilize the patient and you feel their anatomy is best suited for surgery, and the patient is, you know, waking up and you think they might be a surgical candidate, you might have that conversation. Other times you might just try to stabilize them and medically manage them, or you might try to intervene. And I think a lot of us in that situation would probably intervene, meaning by intervene meaning PCI, if you can.
I like it. I like it. So I that's a perfect start to just the end of this type of discussion. I wanted to talk to you about STEMI equivalents. You touched on one, and we kind of hit it hard with the ST depression on the EKG, diffuse ST depression with the elevation of AVR. There are other ones that I see, and I've seen many times. I've never failed to get a patient to the lab with a posterior MI, and that is not a STEMI in the traditional sense, because there's no ST elevation on the EKG.
Yeah, but you got to look for it, and it should be treated one, you know, as one.
Yeah,
they're tricky. I mean, you know, you have to be mindful that you know, an inferior MI usually involves an infarction of the posterior descending artery, which can come off either the left circumflex system or the right coronary artery system. Majority of people are what we could term right dominant, which means they give off the PDA. Mm-hmm. So classically, you can see a little bit of ST elevation pattern in the inferior leads with an R wave and V1, and that would you know, indicate that there could be a posterior MI going, an inferior posterior MI.
Yeah.
If it's a circumflex lesion, it can be a little bit more nebulous on the EKG. You might not see so much. Or you might just see a little, you know, peak of ST elevation and just like a 1 or an AVL, a high lateral lead, or not much at all, but you've got to look and put your posterior leads on.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's a story-driven situation.
Sure, sure. And the thing about what I want to point out to paramedics out in the field is, and you, most of you already know this, but when you have a real proximal lesion in the RCA and the RV is infarcting, you got to stay away from nitrates. You got to understand that this patient is preload dependent. And sometimes with these posterior MIs, the same can be said. They're going to be very prone to hypotension if they're RCA dominant type patients. And these patients, when they get nitro, you can expect a precipitous drop in blood pressure, and it's a very unforgiving type syndrome. So for the paramedics out there, when you have an inferior wall MI, have pause before you give your nitrates to these patients, because they're preload dependent. It's very difficult to get them back once they drop below that threshold, and that's something that I wanted to mention on that same point. The other thing I wanted to mention with respect to STEMI equivalents, we talked about the diffuse ST depression with AVR elevation. We've talked about the posterior wall MI. What is another one that you want to bring
up? Well, I mean, the classic one is left bundle branch block, right?
Ah! So that was something that we always did. Presumably new.
And how many times did they go to the lab?
And they went to the lab all the time. How many times, anecdotally, Dr. Ferreira, did they have a lesion?
Well, I mean, I would say anecdotally, it's probably 50% of the time they go to the lab. You can have a left bundle branch block for other reasons, even in the setting of normal LV function. So it can be just a sign of conduction system disease. If you have no prior EKG and the person is really looking like an LAD infarct with a left bundle, you know, clinically, if they're having the chest pain, they're having the clinical sequelae, I mean, oh, I'm sure take them to the lab. I wouldn't fight that. There are those that, you know, might come in with a little bit of chest pain, you know, their blood pressure's high, they've got signs of hypertensive heart disease. You stabilize them, and I know we're getting off the topic of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, but you stabilize them and they're chest pain free because their blood pressure comes down and everything. And look, that person probably has a chronic left bundle, and maybe you just get a set of markers and follow them. An out of hospital cardiac arrest with the left bundle, you know, if it's an unknown left bundle, I mean, you know, I guess if you want to be guideline heavy, you're going to say that should be treated like STEMI. But
yeah,
I would still take a good, you know, history the best I could with you to try to figure out, like, hey, are there any old EKGs? What's their history? Do we know that they had an old echo that showed their EF was down? Is anything there? If not, then you've got to act however you think is best appropriate for the patient in that clinical situation. But they're tough. The left bundle's tough. You know, but right bundles can be a sign of LAD closure too.
Sure. And a lot of people look at right bundles as being an innocent little thing that some people have and it's of no consequence. But, you know, with left bundles, it gets a little bit more complicated because now we have something called the Scarbosa criteria that we can use in order to determine, does this patient have a STEMI, yes or no?
Yeah, so I've seen, you know, once or twice I've seen a pretty convincing left bundle branch block with signs of infarction and they've had something. So it's rare, but I've seen it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's something that you should be familiar with, I think, you know,
sure.
When you're looking and sizing up a left bundle. Or I guess the counter argument to that is, or additional argument to that is, if you know the patient has a left bundle and it's a known left bundle, is it the same looking left bundle?
Sure.
You know, if
it's something different on the EKG.
Like if you have an old EKG and it looks exactly the same, that's reassuring. You know, but you know, just if they're having chest pain with the left bundle and they had a previous left bundle, that's pretty reassuring. If, you know, there's now suddenly ST elevation of 5 millimeters and, you know, other things, that's a different animal, right?
Yeah.
Or a different patient.
Absolutely.
I shouldn't call patients animals.
No, I got it. You know, the thing about it is, you know, it all boils down, the one common thing that I got from this discussion with you, and I really thank you for coming on the show. It means a lot to the paramedics, to the nurses, to the ED docs and critical care folks alike. What I got was, you know, the gestalt of your clinical intuition means something. You know, when we talk about sending patients to the lab from a cardiac arrest state, everything matters. Everything matters. The story matters. The patient's history matters. The EKG matters. Everything, you know, even you brought up the lactate matters. Put it all together and do what's right for the patient. That's what the take home that I got from the post arrest.
I mean, we're all worried about a DTB, right? We're all worried about a door to balloon time. It's so impressed upon us as cardiologists, and it's impressed upon you as ER treatment team that, hey, you know, this is our goal, door to balloon in 90 or door to needle 60, whatever the case is, wherever you're working. But the reality is that is a great mantra and should be upheld as best as possible. But there are going to be the outliers. And the majority of the outliers are going to be those who require a little bit more consideration and clinical input, which might come through lab work, which might come through imaging. You know, did they fall when they collapsed and hit their head, even though it was a sudden cardiac arrest witness with chest pain and they banged their head on a curb? I mean, geez, that's a guy that I need to know. Does he have a subdural now?
No kidding.
You know, I mean, before I blast him with anticoagulants?
Sure.
So, you know, that's something that is okay to take out of the door to balloon time metric.
Yeah.
And say, this patient, you know, the way I always think about it is, if the patient requires more of a workup, if the patient's clinical story requires more careful consideration that is outside of this door to balloon time window, then it's okay. It doesn't mean that you're going to not be efficient in your workup. Just be efficient in your workup. Don't put the brakes on it. Don't say, okay, we're not going to the cath lab right away on this guy, so let's take our time. No.
Yeah.
You know, scan the head, get the labs, do it all quickly, analyze it, then call me back.
Sure.
You asked earlier, like, you know, who should I call you on? I mean, I don't, it's a phone call, it's a phone call. You can call me on any of them.
Sure.
I mean, you know, that's not a big concern. I don't think anybody should say, you know, don't call me unless the EKG shows STEMI or don't, you know. The reality is these are, This is a patient populace that requires conjoint medical decision making by both ER and cardiology teams. And yes, cardiology team is going to drive a lot of it. I get that, but ER team really is at the forefront of helping stabilize, manage, and work up. And if you ignore any of those things, right, you know, then you're doing a disservice to the patient. You're not appropriately treating that person.
So, yeah. Yeah, I guess I got one more question for you, sure. Dr. Ferrer. And I completely appreciate everything that you've brought to the table today, because I think that this is going to be a show that's going to be well thought of and helpful to the clinician and the emergency department, certainly. But I guess, are we dumb in the emergency department? I mean, like, when you are at home and you get the call, are you thinking, does this person know how to read an EKG, really? I mean, send me the EKG.
I don't even really care about that. I mean, send me the EKG.
Yeah.
Even there are plenty of doctors that I've worked with for a long time, and they call me from the ER, and I trust their EKG skills, and it's always been legitimate. But there's certainly, you know, always an opportunity for us both to evaluate it our own way. So even when it's somebody I trust that's always right, I'll still say, hey, send me the EKG.
Sure.
Let me get my own eyes on it. And in part because, to be honest with you, I mean, sometimes it influences how I approach them in the lab.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, if it looks like an inferior wall STEMI coming from the right, I might, you know, be prepared to go in with a right, you know, interventional catheter. I mean, so it influences what I do. Or if it looks like it's a proxLAD lesion, I might, you know, be prepared to have a balloon pump and, you know, ready and other things. So I'm going to look, but it doesn't mean that you're dumb. I mean, it means I want my own eyes on it for a different reason. And I think that, you know, I think no one's dumb, but what's dumb is not evaluating a situation based on its clinical and merits. If you just check a box like EKG normal, you know, no STEMI workup, but don't manage the patient with, you know, consideration of a cooling protocol or acid-based status, whatever, that's dumb. If you, you know, don't evaluate an EKG at all because you just didn't consider it, that's dumb. Like,
yeah,
you know, put the intuition on the table, evaluate the patient, and get it going. You're only dumb when you don't look or don't ask the questions on how to manage the guy.
Fair enough. And that was well said. So I really appreciate you joining us. It meant a lot to me, and I hope it means a lot to everybody else that listens. So we are going to wrap up now. I want you to tune in for the next episode. That subject matter has yet to be decided, but we appreciate all the downloads that we've had thus far. Please don't forget to check the show notes for evidence-related articles regarding the subject matter. Email questions to rhesusnowquestions@gmail.com. Check out our hosting site at rhesusnow.buzzsprout.com. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Reddit. Available on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, and more. And special thanks to the Fastplants, a punk band from Chicago, for letting us use your music. It means a lot to us. And visit resusleadershipacademy.com for more information on Scott Weingart and Haney Malamet's Virtual Resuscitation Fellowship. As always, thank you for joining us at Resus Now, and thank you, Dr. Ferrer, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
It means a lot to us, sir.
No, my pleasure.
I hope you guys get a lot out of this. Until next time, Rhesus Now.
Okay.